we developed, but never commercialized, a process for passing carbon tetrachloride over fluorspar at a very high temperature, and you could make a mixture of the mono, tri, etc., tetrachloral polymer. Worked fine. But the trouble was in that process, carbon tetrafluoride, I mean, calcium fluoride plus carbon tetrachloride, for instance, you get the freons, then you get calcium chloride, which melts. So the fluorspar would plump up. We had this in a boiling bed kind of thing. So we realized that wasn't practical. Now the calchlor process is another process for going, and I don't know its exact details, for going directly to the fluoral substance.
And we're discussing chart B or 2.
Oh. I'm not sure with whom you should talk for that one. I'd have to do a little thinking. I could get you the man in DuPont who worked on it, but if he's alive, but I have to think. I have to get that out of my head.
Here's an interesting part of this chart where you're talking about semiconductor etching. F-14 sales in semiconductor etching.
It's
must be something very.
It because it's inert. And there again, I can't tell you much. See, some of these things. I have pretty broad knowledge, but I can't know all the details.
Right.
And I try to get, by talking around, or the interviews I conducted, I tried to get a feel for where all these things were going, and what amounted to real business. And in a case like this, the chemistry to me wasn't that important, it was the fact. Because, again, see, I was putting these charts together for a purpose. And I do not know exactly why that's good. Maybe I did, but I forgot it. The F-113 for dry cleaning, that's simple. And this is what it led to the calchlor process I told you about, what
right.
We were doing, trying to do it without HF. That's one that's trifluoromethyl bromide is a fire extinguisher. Yeah, that's the ozone business. Is too bad because there's no good replacement for that, and it's invaluable for airplanes. It's
safe.
Do
they carry it still?
I don't know, but it is just marvelous for a flame. It's the bromine that does the job.
Yeah, it just sends it right down, but taking all the radicals.
It gets into the branch chain reaction that's going on in the conflagration.
Right.
And what you get, the bromine pops the radicals that are leading to the branch chain, and the CF3 things unite, make hexafluoroethane, and it's harmless. Those things we did studies with perfluorocyclobutane. With live animals, and you could forget about the nitrogen, have oxygen and the perfluorocyclobutane, and the animals are perfectly happy. And that goes for lots of similar compounds like that. no effect. It's inert.
Yeah. They actually do use perfluorinated compounds with premature babies.
Yeah. And it they're being used in some blitz, in blood substitutes.
Yes.
For conveying oxygen.
Yep. Very useful things.
Fascinating field.
Well, let's see. Is there anything on this chart we've never talked about that we should talk about? Some of it I see is summary of things we have talked about. This has, it ends in formal commercialization of CalRes.
What?
Formal commercialization of CalRes.
Oh, that's, the formal commercialization happened, I'm just thinking, I think it was 1979.
Yeah, it must be, that's about where.
It came after my laboratory work produced a profit of $1 million, which actually on recalculation, when we got all the figures, was $1.5 million. We had been doodled to that extent by the research division. My own division doodled me, because that was separate. We had separate accounts, and we kept scrupulously accurate accounts.
Well, now, who actually went and sold the things?
What?
Who actually sold the parts to?
Oh, we sold
the
them.
I mean, like you?
The research division. I had four guys work for me.
Uh-huh.
They partly were technical service in the lab, and they went out and visited the customers.
Uh-huh.
There weren't 1 million customers.
Right.
Millions of five. Hell, when you're paying $1,000 for a big O-ring, several $1,000. We sold them to chemical plants, the government, seals for rockets and things like that. And the people you talk to are limited. And I could get some of the names for you if you want, but they were just standard, capable people.
Mm-hmm. Not professional salespersons.
No. But incredible. They had some sales experience.
Uh-huh.
But not the door-to-door salesman type.
Right.
You go into business like this by discussing properties. For instance, I made several trips with a couple of other people to the armed forces, the Air Force and the like, searching for problems. We wanted to solve problems because that way we could make money. And we did not wish the government to sponsor our work. If the government sponsored our work, they would get control of it.
Uh-huh.
We wanted to keep the control of it within our house so that it wouldn't get dispersed all over the place. So we were willing to gamble, do the work.
Mm-hmm.
With the thought that we might find a good customer in here.
Right.
And so I go visit the Air Force, then I go to McDonnell Douglas, I go to Dayton, Wright Field Labs, and in a sense, I talk about these things, have one of my men talk all about the details. In a sense, we're salesmen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Don't take any orders, don't touch a nickel.
Right.
But
no building
they know when they approached us that we'd feel that question down to the proper person. Now, when we made our $1 million+, the vice president says we've got to take that thing out of the research division. It doesn't belong in the research division, which is true. So they picked a guy who was all full of stuff and nonsense, but didn't know anything. One of these guy they picked off of their skimmer chart, they thought he might be promotable. They put him in charge of this and almost killed him. He really blew it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have the kind of business that CalRES is, you have to work to find the outlets where it belongs. It's a little bit like going after gold. You're looking for a vein of gold in some ore, and you pursue that vein till it runs out. So what you have to do if you run a business like this is you have to keep looking for new gold, new places to do it. You understand me okay?
This is new places to sell it or new places to do research?
Well, you do the research to find a place where you can sell it. This is really money motivated.
Sure.
But it's
where,
a very
where
high
need
place.
It?
But
where do they need it?
Yeah, where do they need it? And nobody is going to pay thousands of dollars. We were selling that stuff for anywhere, depending on what we were selling, from $1,000 to $10,000 a pound.
Right.
But there's a hell of a lot of work in making that $10,000. That thing was costly.
Said that its properties were so superior.
Yeah, it was the only thing that would work.
It would save millions.
That's
by
right,
spending
that's
thousands.
Right. Yeah, they spent a few $1,000s, and that's why I pushed so hard. Let's sell on value and use. Let's not sell by the pound. Sell what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in a medical profession, the fellow that can do brain surgery or heart surgery makes a lot more than the medic who's taking care of your toes.
I, who am about to undergo toe surgery.
Oh, that right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I hope he's good. It can be very painful.
Right.
I know that's not cheering, but it's...
Right.
The surgery won't be painful. It's the recovery.
So, I wonder if you'd reflect about what is the optimal environment for making innovation. I mean, these charts were supposed to tell the higher ups how can we find another nylon. That it was flowing into that era of DuPont, right?
Well, first thing you have to understand that the thing like nylon is rare, very rare.
Uh huh.
Because that was a scratch into a new field. And there aren't that many new fields. Interesting one is, a new field is in this area of how to make printed circuits. The kind of things you need to do that. Or another interesting new field is, or has been, it isn't anymore, how to get at the inks and techniques that you can use for making colored things that are so good, like the color prints you can make on a computer these days. Starting with the technology, the beginning was pretty damn poor.
Right.
And that took advances in the inks, tremendous advances in the inks, advances in the electronics and the mechanical part of the printing.
Microfluidics.
Yeah, right, yeah. The fluids it's very complex. Are you talking about it back at the laboratory?
Right. I mean, if you're not going to do invent nylon, you were describing several polymers that were really very important polymers and yeah. that earned the company a lot of money, which I assume yeah. the higher ups in DuPont were interested in duplicating those sorts of phenomena, and not the blockbuster of all blockbusters.
Well,
creating a surroundings where people do these things.
Yeah, well, the point I was trying to make is nylon is an extreme exception.
Right.
And the chance of finding another nylon is a little bit like going after the needle in the haystack. There's a lot of luck. The field was virgin back there. Polymers were just barely understood from Staudinger's work. In fact, it wasn't even Staudinger's work wasn't even believed. A lot of people thought polymers were just associations. The work that DuPont and Charlie Stein had the vision to want to go to look, take a look at polymers. And that's why they tried to hire Carruthers.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to Carruthers to work on this problem was a little bit like a seduction. They failed with one guy, and then they loosed their most foresighted man in the central research. Hamilton Bradshaw, very bright man, on Carruthers, and he seduced him. Carruthers had to be persuaded to work on polymers. They wanted Carruthers and wanted him to work on polymers. Carruthers chose to go at it very systematically, like an orthodox organic chemist with high capability, and proceeded to synthesize a high ester. He synthesized a polyester. He tried to synthesize a polyamide and couldn't process it. He then figured he understood polymers and wanted to do something else. His boss, director of the department, Elmer Bolton, had a golden finger. His golden finger was behind neoprene, and his golden finger worked in this case. He asked Carruthers if Carruthers would please go back with one of his men and take another look at the polyamides before he left the field. And they put a couple of very good chemists on it. And they succeeded in making good polyamides. They were making them from some basic acid. It's a 10-carbon acid obtained from pyrolysis of castor oil. Here again, Bolton's gold finger said that's not a good basis for a business. Let's see if we can do it with something that's based on benzene, 6-carbon. So they synthesized hexamethylene polyadipamide. Just good judgment and knowledge. So, who did it?
right.
Yeah, who did it?
Sounds like it took a serendipitous team.
Yeah, it took a combination of luck and good chemistry and capable people. Adults very rarely make great chemical discoveries and physical discoveries. Boy, it was fun to work in this area, the whole area. My whole life, I had a ball.
Yeah, when you tell the story, it was just a simple joy that you
What is joy?
Radiate.
The process of innovation with which I was intimately involved. One way or another, I got five things off the ground into business. It's a joy. It's like having children without the labor. But there is labor doing the work.
As Rudy Pariser said to me, yeah, he was the best boss I ever had. And he was talking about you.
Yeah. Well, what you have to... You have to create an enthusiasm in the people who are doing the work. An awful lot of people who go to work in industry get a degree, go to work, and they become clods. That's because they're in a dead, stultifying atmosphere. Anybody, I took the view that anybody who looked good to us when we saw him coming out of the university was highly educated, might not be a genius, but he was capable of doing something good somewhere, and you try to find that out with the people. And what I tried to do was understand what they were doing. I was a good chemist once. Really was. I graduated top of my class at Harvard, got a SOMA.
I saw that.
Got through graduate school fast.
But I was telling you, I thought, wow.
Once upon a time, I was a good chemist.
Uh-huh.
But in this world, I'm a dinosaur. I know that. You know, it's natural.
But we can learn from the dinosaurs.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes, yeah.
Watch out when the meteor is coming.
Right, right. Well, that's still arguable. Because the process of dinosaur extinction was going on before that. Well, on a research organization, basically, you're trying to create an environment where the people know that they're understood and they know that they're expected to do something. And my philosophy wasn't that you should direct somebody in detail. You should tell them what you wanted to get out of them clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And leave them alone. And if he did it well, okay, things go on. Sometimes people couldn't handle that. Sometimes you're dealing with people where you have to tell them what to do. Then you transfer them to the plant. Or if they're all gas, you transfer them to sales. You know, yeah. I remember we had two bright-eyed and bushy-tailed characters in our sales division who impressed the dickens out of the management. And I told, the way I classified those boys, they were the gonad twins.
The gonad?
Gonad twins. They had nothing, really, except the ability to gas. By gonads, I meant they were all full of stuff.
Right.
They were
right.
Loaded with testosterone.
Right.
That's all.
And the world needs some of those.
Of course, of course. And that's the whole point. When you get these people, that's what I'm trying to say. You get these people, you know there's something there. Now, these guys in sales, I never hired them. They hired them.
Yeah, I had a boss once who I worked in at Goucher College.
Uh-huh.
And he was a chemist, the dean, and he'd worked for IBM. And he had a PhD in chemistry from, I think, Northern Illinois. Now, his account of it is that he had to produce so many whatevers, you know, per month. So this he found very boring, so he did those right in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then he stuffed them in a drawer, and then he did what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then he came forth with the four whatevers. It sounded like, in his case, he was having to report progress of some sort on a regular basis, which wasn't, him. You know, he wanted the big problem or whatever. And it sounded like you gave your guys quite a bit of rein, free rein.
Well, I don't know.
Well, this has been absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, but not.
I think we're going to take you away from your lunch if we don't wrap it up.
Okay.
But the level of enthusiasm for industrial science is infectious.
Yeah. Well, any kind of science, but we didn't have to. I never had to do what a faculty has to do to get grants, support.
Right.
I always had good support. Once they found out what I could do anything. I didn't have to work on any. They give me a problem, I work on something else. They were happy. And I except that business I told you about, the Viton, where we wanted to do the work and the management said don't, and I did. But DuPont was a good outfit to work with at that time.
Do you think it's changed, or you don't get enough?
I can't speak to it because I haven't been there now for 25 years. If it hasn't changed, it's dead. Because an organization has to change. And whether that change makes you happy or not, I don't know. But they have to change.
Yes. So when things stop changing, we say they reach equilibrium.
They're dead.
And when things reach equilibrium, they're dead.
Yeah, the reaction stops. Nothing comes out of it. You sort of have a stasis or stasis situation.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, you're welcome. Much. This was wonderful.
If you have more questions, give me a call.
Okay.
We can find another way to get up here.